Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Tracy Smith. I'll be presiding today. Also on the panel with me are Judge Frisch and Judge Hooten. Now, you cannot see Judge Hooten's video because there was some conflict with video and audio. So Judge Hooten can hear everything and will participate, but you just won't be able to see her. So the first case this morning is there are three case numbers, A20-0584, A20-0592, the first one is 84, second one 94. State of Minnesota versus Sharmaki Mohammed Aden. And counsel, Mr. McGeaney is here for appellant, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Great, and Mr. Triggs for the respondent. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. So we will begin with counsel for appellant. State your name and the party you represent for the record and go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Jim McGeaney. I'm attorney for Midwest Bonding LLC, appellant in all three of these consolidated appeals, which all involve a question about whether the district court abused her discretion in imposing large penalties in the reinstatement orders on all three bonds. For purposes of this argument, I'd prefer just to refer to the appeals as the Aden, Idy, and Moore cases to keep it short. I only got 15 minutes for three, but my argument's fairly simple. First, I'd like to raise an issue just before I forget that the state of Minnesota waived their appearance in the district court in all three of these files. And I think this court's held for quite some time that if you don't argue an issue in the district court, you basically waive your right to argue those issues on appeal. So it's appellant's position that the state's basically waived their ability to argue their position in this appeal because they did not appear in the district court, make any argument, file any brief or affidavit.
Did you in your briefing, apropos of forfeiting something, did you make this argument in your briefing?
I did not. Okay. I failed to do that. But after reviewing the record, the transcripts reveal that the state waived their appearance and didn't appear at any of the hearings.
So I wonder if you forfeited. My question is, did you forfeit this argument about waiver by not raising it in your briefing?
I guess I'll leave that to the court's discretion. I don't know. You have to raise it in your brief to bring it up in argument. In either case, I think that we prevail anyway. The state, I'm familiar with the state's position. They just basically think the district court didn't abuse her discretion. The real question here, I think if you read the district court's order, the district court basically does a quasi-Shetsky analysis on all three of these orders and doesn't really make a determination that the Shetsky factors weigh against reinstatement and discharge. The district court, in our opinion, just randomly imposed significant penalties on Midwest Bonding in its reinstatement orders. In the Aden case, the district court imposed a 75% penalty of $14,000. In the Idy case, it's an 80% penalty, $20,000. And in the Moore case, it's a 67% penalty, two-thirds of the bond, but the most amount. That was a $50,000 penalty. And I don't like to describe cases ever as run-of-the-mill because we all know that every case has its own facts and circumstances. But generally, these three cases are somewhat typical forfeiture cases where a defendant fails to appear at a district court hearing. They're apprehended, we believe, not very long later. The longest period of absence from the court is Idy. And I won't take this court's time this morning. I argued it in my brief about the district court's error in calculating the amount of days that Idy was absent on Midwest bond, because the district court added days after Idy was apprehended and appeared before the district court on the bond at issue in this appeal. He failed to appear again. It's our position that that shouldn't be held against Midwest, that that shouldn't be calculated in his time absent from the court. So presuming you agree with that argument, the longest absence is 121 days, which is not unusual. And I find it interesting. I've got two appellate judges who both work for University of Minnesota. I don't know if I've ever had that before. I know Judge Hooten's been a district court judge, and it's not uncommon for a criminal defendant to fail to appear for a hearing for various reasons that I don't know that are particularly relevant, because my analysis in my briefing, I cite this court to case law that says basically the fact that a defendant willfully fails to appear for court should not automatically trump appellant's good faith efforts. And the good faith efforts are outlined in the affidavits. I concede,
counsel, this is an abuse of discretion standard. And I think yes. With that statement of that, you know, willful non-appearance doesn't trump the other factors. Basically, that tells us that there are, I think under Shetsky, there are four factors that need to be balanced. They don't all four need to be met in one direction. They need to be, you know, weighed and considered by the district court, and then in the district court's discretion, make a decision. So in this case, the district court went through each of the factors, at the end made a decision, maybe didn't explicitly say, having weighed these factors, I conclude that the following is the appropriate, but I think it's in, you know, I mean, by describing all the factors, coming to conclusions about each of them, and then deciding what particularly makes that an abuse of discretion, or how do we know, I mean, doesn't, we, I guess what makes that an abuse of discretion here? And you're saying they should be fully, there should have been no penalty whatsoever. And how, what's, is that your argument? And where's the abuse?
Well, that's a great question, Your Honor. And that comes up in all these cases, right? In the bond forfeiture cases, which is an area of my practice that I argue often. What is an abuse of discretion? Is a district court's discretion unfettered? You know, there's a line out of Farsdale versus Minnesota, the respondent cites it in their brief, where it says, a court's abuse this discretion when the determination is illogical and contrary to facts. And of course, the black letter law is the court abuses its discretion when it misapplies the law. So what is factually distinguishable in this case or in these cases that warrant what we would term a penalty that's only being imposed to punish the surety and increase the revenue of the state, which are both prohibited under the Shetsky case, which establishes the four-factor test? And so what's logical about imposing a 75% penalty in Aden, for instance, when you review the Shetsky factors, there's no prejudice, there's good faith efforts by the bond company, and the purpose of bail has been satisfied in analyses of this court's decisions over time when an offender is gone for 97 days. Why is it within a court's discretion to impose that kind of penalty? It's a rhetorical question, of course, because there's no answer in the case law.
That's my question, counsel. Is there some authority that requires a district court to say why it is imposing the actual penalty that it is imposing? Does it have to say, I'm imposing a $19,000 penalty because X? Is there some authority that requires a district court to go that far?
I don't know the case that holds that, but I think the cases that talk about the district court's ultimate order being illogical and contrary to the facts, there's some guidance for the district courts. You know, General Rule Practice 702 regarding bail bonds and the published case, it's State v. Mulcahy. I didn't cite it because it didn't come up in my brief, but it's a published opinion from this court that talks about the 10% penalty that's mandatory when a surety fails to file a petition to reinstate a forfeited bond within 90 days of the order that forfeited the bond. You know, in these cases, for instance, in Aden, the order was issued February 13th. The defendant was in custody 11 days later, and the appellant, we filed our petition well within the 90 days. So to give the court some, I think to give the appellate courts and the district court, if you look at what authority there is, there's Rule 702. And Rule 702 says, hey, you've got 90 days to get your petition filed. Otherwise, we're going to penalize you 10% of your bond. And here, we filed our petition within the 90 days. It using 90 days as a kind of guidelines. Adden's gone from the jurisdiction of the court for 97 days. The state presents no evidence of prejudice. There's no prejudice to the state. And yet the district court imposes a 75% penalty. That's illogical. And that's probably the only case like on point, Your Honor, too, is as Farsdale talks about that in order to be a good exercise of discretion, the decision has to be logical with the facts of the case. There's nothing in either or any of these three cases that jump out and say, wait a minute, you know, the surety here was egregious. They made no efforts to try to apprehend the defendant. They deserve, I guess, a deserving penalty of 75%. And so an abuse of discretion is when you can't rationalize the amount of money that you're requiring the surety to pay towards the facts of the case.
Is it your contention also, counsel, that it's an abuse of discretion for the district court not to expressly weigh the four Shetsky factors? I mean, for example, when we have an appeal from a motion for a temporary injunction, the district court abuses its discretion if it does not weigh the Dahlberg factors. I'm not aware of any authority that requires the district court to weigh the four Shetsky factors. Are you?
But I know that this court's reversed district courts for not considering the Shetsky factors in its order and remanded for findings. I've been involved in a few cases where this court's remanded a case back because the district court failed to properly either analyze or apply the Shetsky factors. So I think, how the court weighs the Shetsky factors, it's not clear from the district court's order here. It appears from reading the orders that the district court acknowledges that the factors weigh in favor of reinstatement and discharge of the bonds in all three cases and in all four factors in all three cases. And then the district court seems to kind of just pull a number out of thin air. Yeah, well, in this case, the defendant's gone for 110 days. It's going to cost you $50,000. And that's the more matter. In ID, the defendant's gone for 120 days. That's going to cost you $20,000.
Why aren't those determinations within the district court's discretion?
Because the Shetsky, the seminal case, says that the primary purpose of bail is not to punish the surety or to increase the revenue of the state. And on the face of it, those numbers appear to do both those things without some other kind of analysis to say, you know what, your behavior was bad, appellant. You didn't do what you're supposed to do. And well,
can't we infer that by an absence of over 100 days?
I don't think so. I think that this court's made, there's numerous cases, I've cited a few of them in my brief, where a defendant absent for over 100 days that's back into custody with no prejudice to the state, the purpose of bail has been satisfied. And so I don't know that the number of days absent is the triggering issue in the amount of bail.
So is it your claim that some of the Shetsky factors trump the others?
No, but I think, yeah, yes. Let me say, I think the prejudice to the state is the key, that if there's no prejudice.
So if there's no prejudice to the state, then the entire bond should be reinstated.
If not the entire bond, the penalty more in the lines of what the rules of practice, Rule 702 mentions or suggests, right? It's a 10% mandatory penalty, and this court's held it's mandatory if you don't file a petition within 90 days. So that's misconduct, or not misconduct, but that's a mistake by the surety. Here, the surety didn't even do that, and yet is being punished severely in all three of these bonds for what appears to be punishment and increasing the revenue of the state. So I think that, although it's, I don't want to say there should be a rule of law that one factor trumps the other. When you don't have prejudice, that really, it favors the bond company because the purpose of bail satisfied, the state's not prejudiced. So what's the rationale for imposing a $50,000 penalty on the surety and maybe the Moore family the surety is probably going to try to indemnify and go after for that money, should this court affirm. What's the purpose? You know, why is that within a court's discretion? That seems to me unfettered discretion that's not subject to appellate review. There's no rationale behind the penalties that the district court imposed. The state argues that because appellant didn't apprehend these defendants, that it's within the court's discretion. But I find no case, and I don't know that there's a case that says that just because appellant or the surety doesn't apprehend the defendant, that warrants a huge penalty of more than 50% of the bond amount, up to 80% in these cases. In Mr. Idy's circumstance, the court forfeited 80% of the bail bond.
Counsel, I was going to ask you about that. Does that matter at all? Like, you're saying it doesn't justify the fact that the surety didn't secure the defendants.
I don't think so.
It should not be considered at all under Shepsky, is your view?
I think it should be considered whether the surety makes efforts and whether those efforts are in good faith. And that's in our affidavits. But I don't know that the surety should be the one to apprehend the defendant. And I see I'm out of time. So I'll reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Kyle Triggs. My name is Kyle Triggs. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'm asking this court to affirm the district court's decision on all three files. And to reiterate, there's a number of things that these three cases have in common when it comes to the court's discretion. In all three cases, the district court analyzed all four Shetsky factors. In all three cases, the defendants willfully failed to appear and went missing for at least 2 months or more. In all three cases, the court credited the surety for making some good faith efforts, but in none of the three did Midwest actually play a role in the defendant's apprehension. In all three cases, most importantly, the district court did forgive a portion of the bond. They forgave anywhere from 20 to 33% of the bond after acknowledging that they did make some good faith efforts. I would further note that in all three cases, the forgiven portion either matched or exceeded whatever cost the bonding company claims they incurred. I would point out in Aiden, Midwest claimed they spent $1,900 on a recovery agent. And in that case, they forgave $5,000 of the $19,000. In Edy, Midwest claimed it spent $5,000 on bounty hunter feeds. And in that case, the court forgave $5,000. In Stavey Moore, there was no documentation of cost provided whatsoever. And yet in that case, the court forgave $25,000 of the $75,000.
But aren't we hamstrung a little bit because in our review of what the district court did, because we don't have any information about how the district court weighed the Shetsky factors? I mean, we do have a mixed bag here. The district court acknowledges that some factors weigh in favor of reinstatement and discharge and some weigh in favor of forfeiture. So how do we know, how can we decide even whether the district court abused its discretion when we don't know how the district court arrived at its conclusion and the amount of the forfeiture?
Your Honor, I would say that we look at the district court's analysis to make sure it analyzed every factor. And in this case, it did. And when we look at the Shetsky factors, we're looking at the totality of the circumstances and examining the relevant facts under each one. In this case, there are some facts that are in favor of discharge, but it's important to remember, we're not facing the question of, do we forgive the entire amount or do we forgive nothing? There's middle ground. And I think one of the, Your Honors pointed this out, even if the court doesn't say this amount represents this, we can infer that from the findings. In this case, we can safely infer that what the district court was saying is, look, this was a willful non-appearance for all three defendants. You made some good faith efforts, but the efforts were somewhat limited compared to other cases, and they were not responsible for bringing them back. And the justice was delayed for some period of time. Taking everything together, you made some good efforts, so I'll give you some of your money back. That we can infer from the district court's order, and that's all the law requires, really, is for the district court to meaningfully consider all four Shetsky factors. And when counsel points out that the district court, when they talk about illogical reasoning that counsel made, really what defense counsel is referring to is a decision they disagree with. Well, reasonable minds can differ. The question before us is whether the court went outside that range of reasonableness where reasonable minds can differ. And here that did not happen. In one of the cases where it did happen, it was cited in the appellant's brief, and I apologize to the court, I can't remember the name. It was a case where the district court had released a defendant knowing he was going to go straight into federal custody. And the bail bond company posted the bail. Defendant went almost immediately into federal custody. So really, that was a situation where no one could expect the bail bond company to do anything about it, and yet their bond was forfeited. That's a situation where that makes no sense. It just plainly makes no sense. But here, that's entirely different. You do have a notable absence. You do have limitations in efforts. As I pointed out in my brief, they make some efforts. But again, in the case law, the courts talk about how, well, there's some good faith efforts, but it matters if you play a role in their apprehension. It can matter. And the reason that's very important to know, and I know that defense counsel points out we waived our appearance at the district court level. And the reason I'm fighting this now, of course, is we're now talking about the district court's discretion and the incentive that we need for bail companies to make the greatest efforts. You see, when defense counsel says, well, we made good faith efforts and that's all that matters. The problem with that is if we issue a ruling saying by law, if there's no prejudice and you made some efforts, you automatically get your money back. The problem is there will be no incentive for bond companies to go more, to put in more than great, some good faith efforts. There will never be an incentive to put in maximum efforts. And that's, of course, what we want them to do. We want that to be an incentive. We want to avoid one extreme where we make it always impossible to get their money back, but we also don't want to make it too easy where some good faith efforts is all they need, because otherwise, why would they go above and beyond good faith efforts if mere some good faith efforts is all that's needed? So that's the point I would stress on that, Your Honor. I think it was raised too that for Stevie Edie, the court counted custody time. And I would just point out for Your Honors, at no point in the order did the court specifically say, I am holding the bail company responsible for not getting him out of custody. The court was very clearly just looking at the total delay, which is relevant to whether we're frustrating the purpose of the timely administration of justice. And another point on counsel's argument about the reasoning, and to get to Your Honor's point, I'm sorry, I'm a little jumping all over the place. Your Honor was asking about how do we know the reasoning behind a number. And an analogy that comes to mind is the bail hearings themselves, where a court has to decide how much bail to require for a defendant. The court has taken into account flight risk, the severity of the offense, the safety concerns. We want them to take everything into account, and the court will pronounce the bail amount. Now, we hardly ever see a judge say, I'm imposing this much money because of the flight risk, and then this much more money because of the safety concern. And every day, the court takes everything into account and arrives at the best number they can. It's really the same thing here, where we talk about, you made some good faith efforts, I will forgive some portion of the bond, which I would, again, reiterate, it either matched or exceeded the amount that Midwest claimed it spent in trying to recover the defendant. Our position is the court struck the right balance here. It stayed well within the boundaries of discretion, and they have not pointed out anything that the court has stated factually incorrect. They have not pointed out how the court in any way misinterpreted the law. Basically, all they have pointed out is that they disagree with the court's decision and nothing more. But under the law, under the abuse of discretion standard, that's not enough. And so for all these reasons, we as the state would be asking that this court affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes as soon as that comes up on the clock.
Thank you. A couple of things to note. There were some questions about the willfulness and how that applies to the circumstances here. And if you review the district court's memorandums, in ID, the district court concedes that the good faith efforts of Midwest outweighed the willfulness of the defendant and found that that factor actually weighed in favor of reinstatement and discharge. A review of all four, well, three of the orders shows that the district court appears to say, and in Moore as well, specifically, the district court says that Moore's willful absence from the district court does not outweigh the good faith efforts made by Midwest. So you have the district court acknowledging that Midwest's good faith efforts override or outweigh the defendant's willfulness and the failure to appear, and yet the state arguing that the good faith efforts weren't enough because we didn't apprehend these defendants. And I practice criminal defense as well as appeals and bond issues, and I'm sure Judge Hooten could probably verify that the large majority of offenders who fail to appear are apprehended by law enforcement. And to answer Judge Smith's question about whether Midwest or the surety in any case needs to be the one to apprehend the defendant, I don't think this court in its precedent thinks that that's the case. That would make it very difficult for a surety to come in and successfully argue that the factor weighs in favor of reinstatement and discharge when they haven't apprehended the defendant themselves.
Right. My question was whether it's relevant, and I guess it would be relevant to going to the good faith efforts, if anything.
Correct.
Right.
I appreciate that, Judge. Yeah.
Yeah. So in this case, as I don't know if you said two or all three of them, that the district court concluded that some good faith efforts, you say in the memo, the court concluded outweighed the willful non-appearance. So that, as I look at that, that is a statement then that factor three outweighs factor two. Factor four, I think there was no prejudice to the state in any of them. So then we're left with, I think, factor one and how that, how that plays in. So what do the memos tell us about the first factor and how, what that favors?
The memo is mostly silent on how that factor weighed. In other words, the court doesn't make a conclusion that the purpose of bail has been satisfied. That's the magic language in this court's opinions, right? The cases I cite support our arguments that, and I want to just step back. I think when you analyze the first factor, you're also connecting the fourth factor. It's longstanding in any case where an offender is still at large, the purpose of bail has not been satisfied and the state's prejudiced because they can't prosecute that offender. If there's no prejudice, and the offender is back in custody, the purpose of bail has been satisfied. And I don't know that the numbers are that important. I cite the cases to this court just to support our argument that the numbers aren't that important. This court's found when an offender is absent for 7 months, I think that's the Storkamp case, 7 month absence when an offender is back in custody, there's been no prejudice and the state can prosecute that offender, the purpose of bail has been satisfied. I don't believe that the district court here made any specific finding in any of these cases about the purpose of bail being satisfied. The court just kind of tallied the days and said the offender was absent for this many days. In ID, I believe, where the court does compare the length of those absences to some other cases and say, well, he was gone longer than these guys were gone. And that's the case where we disagree with the extra 60 days. But again, I think, Your Honor, that if you look at whether the state's been prejudiced, once the offender's back in custody, whether they were absent for 3 days or 150 days, if there's no prejudice, the purpose of bail has been satisfied. You have the offender, they're available for prosecution. And that's the whole reason. And there's some analysis, and I'll end with this. If you're going to punish the surety for the length of the defendant's absence, what's the surety's motivation to go look for the guy? Because if we don't get him within 30 days, we're going to lose, right? So after 30 days, we'll just stop looking. And Chesky talks about that, and my time is up, so thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you, Your Honor.